made something or an honorable Mabasa. Yeah, he requested your presence at least for 15 minutes.
The point is that there is a dilemma between committees and between chairpersons and whips. So what I do learn is that if it is a committee week, EDD on Wednesdays sits in the morning, if it is a committee week. So this is a committee week, according to what Nduli says, and because it is a committee week, it then means EDD's day. But what I will do, I will go there and make the point that you are making with that you made with him. So that, because we must be guided by, you know, facts. I can't choose one committee above another committee. I can only go to the one that's legitimate according to the schedule. So let me go there, and I will be guided by the schedule.
Yes. I won't respond to the matter because I did last year the exact matter. So, and I'm sure everyone is aware of the response I made. So you are excused. This was requested, and I said we would send you when you arrived on the mobile bar. The other apologies, we don't have another apology that I'm aware of, except a late telephonic apology from the whip, Honorable Hademe. Otherwise, there are two members absent without apology, full members, and that is the Honorable Kamalo and the Honorable Lavinia. So we will have to ascertain what the validity is of the absence this morning. We move on now to the agenda. We had an exigency this morning due to certain people's delay in the traffic, but otherwise, having started at 20 past, we're running 20 minutes to 25 minutes late, and we'll try and then take some from when we close and reduce our tea break by 5 minutes. So on that basis of the detailed progress report on IPAP 2, the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the consideration of the minutes, tea break, and then the nips that we hope to nip in the bud this time and tackle it in detail, commitment and its alignment to IPAP 2, which has been very effectively at least put on paper so far from Mr. Nimrod. Thank you very much. So if we can then have someone to adopt the agenda, please.
Move.
Who was that?
We have moved for the adoption.
Oh, right. Thank you, Honourable Ambrosini. Seconded. Thank you, Honourable Kovasa. Thank you very much. Sorry, Mr. Zolt. I think sometimes we get a little too informal. My apologies. A detailed progress report on IPAP 2. Now, that happens to be the mandate, the priority mandate of this committee, industrialization with trade. So please, Mr. Zolk, if I realize you've been delayed here, 9:30, but if you could try and speak to it, and perhaps certainly after 20 minutes to half an hour, allow us to make some intervention on questions and comments. If you have to continue, of course you will. That all right. Thank you. Over to yourself. All our members, of course, because we do have new members here. That is a DTG in Trade and Industry, the Department of Trade and Industry, and
Can you say, my name is Masizake Zimela, I'm the Chief Director of the National Industrial Cooperation Program, Industrial Development Division of TTI.
I'm Bianca Mugwena. I'm from the Industrial Policy Unit, IDD.
Good morning. My name is Dukisa Mapai, Director in Industrial Policy.
Right, that's why we never got the one of the speakers at the back, because we couldn't hear him or her. So would you repeat that?
Good morning. I'm Ramona Mutin, with the Industrial Participation Secretary.
Thank you, Chair. Just to outline what we intend to present today, first of all, Chair, we'd like to recall that we reported late last year quite considerable detail on the implementation of the most recent iteration of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, including tabling the 2010-11 annual report. What we'd like to do in this presentation is reflect on the progress with the Industrial Policy Action Plan, particularly in relation to creating platforms for the further scaling up of this work. Also to give a brief update on progress and development since the last time we reported to the committee, and lastly to identify key strategic areas and sectors that we intend to scale up in the next iteration of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, which will be launched in April of this year. When we take a bit of a step back and look at what we have put in place since Cabinet approved the Industrial Policy Action Plan in 2007, we're of the view that there's been significant progress and achievements, particularly in relation to putting in place some strategic platforms to facilitate industrialization. These include, in relation to public procurement, the work that we've done with National Treasury and Economic Development, leading to the revised preferential procurement regulations, which allow the Minister of Trade and Industry to designate certain sectors that are subject to public procurement for domestic production. There's been a tremendous amount of technical work to give effect to that, including the development of a methodology and the compilation of the necessary research to put in place the first round of designation, which we'll indicate later in the presentation. Secondly, we've effectively, at the request of National Treasury, largely driven the technical work for them to draft the guidelines and instructions that give effect to these amended regulations. And we've also worked with SABS to put in place a technical standard that defines what is local content and guides everybody in this area on what is local content. On the industrial financing front, and I think we facilitated a refocusing by the Industrial Development Corporation of their funding, particularly on the Industrial Policy Action Plan and new growth prospectors. This includes them identifying around 102 billion rand for potential investment in new growth path and ITAP sectors over 5 years, as well as more specific identification of funding, so for instance a 10 billion job creation fund at quite concessional interest rates, primarily 3% over 5 years, earmarking 25 billion towards the green economy,
ongoing work around, particularly around identifying financing mechanisms for longer-term funding in some of the IPAS sectors. We've also, we think, forged a more strategic direction in conjunction with the competition policy on and focus of the competition authority on impediments to industrialization, as well as focusing on goods and services that are bought by poor and working class households. There have been some important achievements, we think, with the competition authority, including settlements of SAFOL and grain trading and storage companies in relation to anti-competitive behavior. There's been a range of investigations in sectors in these two categories, those that impact on industrialization, those that impact on poor and working class households, like fertilizer, maize and wheat milling, bread, milk, etc., steel and so forth. There are also a number of cases which have been referred and are currently being heard by the tribunal in these types of sectors. We've also put in place, we believe, a much more strategic approach to trade policy, which doesn't a priori say that we have a high tariff regime or a low tariff regime, but rather a strategic tariff regime. And in line with this, the International Trade Administration Commission has processed a number of applications, really looking at what are the conditions in particular sectors. And so in some cases there have been increases, in some cases they've put in rebate facilities, in others they've reduced duties. There's also been a stronger focus on ensuring conditionality in the introduction of those duties. And the standards institutions, we are also gradually refocusing, first of all, to put in place, focus on putting in place standards that will facilitate the growth of new industries. And a lot of their work has been taking place in the area of helping to facilitate green industries. So putting in place enabling standards around things like solar water heaters, renewable energy, biofuels, and so forth, as well as scaling up their enforcement capability and their interaction with other authorities like the South African Revenue Service to deal with non-compliant products. Related to that has been the work with FARS on facilitating their efforts to scale up around addressing customs fraud and other illegal import matters. So in this respect, they conducted about 112 raids last year. Over 3 years, confiscated around R1 billion of goods. They've also been modernizing their system, which enabled them to better identify red warning lights about where contraventions may be happening, as well as supporting a modest uptick in employment in these sectors. On the business process services front, call centers and similar types of activities, the dedicated program and incentive that we have in place here have also attracted significant investment of the order of about 3.4 billion rand and about 1,273 jobs being created. One of the successes, we believe, of this program has been the associated Monyekla training program, where we have worked with the industry and put in place funding for the industry to train young people to work in the sector. About 3,400 people have gone through the Monyekla training program, and with about a 70% placement rate amongst the companies in the sector. And then there are also been recent developments like the Amazon African Customer Service Center being located in Cape Town. On the green industry front, which we'll indicate later, is we believe is a major area for scaling up. There's also been significant work. We put in place new energy efficient building regulations last year. Inter alia, this requires that pretty much most new buildings must now install solar water heaters. And so this is a major way of using standards to help create new industries. We've completed our solar and wind manufacturing strategy. And these will be launched very, very soon publicly, although they've already been subject to significant consultation and comment. The committee will also recall that last year the Department of Energy put in place its Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program and put out the first tranche of tenders for the 17.8 gigawatts that we have committed to the integrated resource plan, and the first RFP was put out in August last year. One of the areas that we secured with National Treasury and with Department of Energy is that localization, local content is a fundamental part of that procurement process, and that we will be ongoing ramping up the minimum levels of local content required. We've also launched an industrial energy efficiency program to try and help manufacturing companies deal with very large increases in electricity that we've seen, as well as driving the bulk of the technical work in relation to the regulations which have been published for comment on biofuels by the Department of Energy. And again, this is another sector that we see as a major new sector with significant employment creation potential. Since we last reported to the Portfolio Committee, the key developments include the preferential procurement regulations, revised preferential procurement regulations came into effect on the 7th of December, allowing Minister of Trade and Industry to designate sectors. We accordingly, prior to that deadline, have designated by notification to the Minister of Finance the following industries: buses, rolling stock for rail procurement, power pylons in relation to electricity procurement, demonstrated in sectors such as automotive, clothing, textiles, leather and footwear, and business process services, the capability to design and implement these kinds of interventions at a sectoral level, and we believe that this now creates the platform for further scaling up, where we see, for instance, first of all, in the relation to procurement, there will be further designations in the number of other sectors. Working with the SOEs and public enterprises, the deepening of supply development policies and systems, the work with the economic development and undertaking with provinces and municipalities to strengthen their capabilities to procure locally in non-designated sectors, and also working with the social part, key social partners, business and labour, to ensure that they give effect to the co-commitment in the procurement accord. On the industrial financing front, there will be ongoing work with the Industrial Development Corporation to leverage the financing that they have, and also finding ways to package the kind of on-budget financing that DGI has with the largely debt financing that IDC is able to provide in a way that is more than the sum of its parts. There will also be the launch and rollout of the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program. And just obviously we can't preempt the budget, but I think to give the committee a kind of indicative really identified three areas for specific focus on scaling up, building on the platforms we've put in place. This is first of all the green industries. We're looking very seriously at designation of solar water heaters and other areas related to renewable generation of electricity, componentry into the renewable generation of electricity. We want to draw on the new competitiveness program to provide appropriate financing for existing companies to move into the green industry space and to deploy the capabilities that they've developed. Let's say in engineering or particular kinds of fabrication into this new sector, and also leverage the opportunities that arise from the new building regulation, energy efficient building regulations. We think there are a number of opportunities in relation to particular types of building materials, solar water heaters, and so forth. And then looking further into the future, I think also working with Department of Science and Technology around areas like fuel cell technology, drawing on the fact that we have a very strong source of platinum group metals in South Africa, which are key for fuel cell technology. In the agro industries area, we want to focus on scaling up our interventions in areas like food processing, beverages, and confectionery, identifying areas where it's possible to replace imports like soybean meal and oil, furniture, and various processed food products, using a range of instruments, including the new competitiveness program, as well as standards and compulsory specifications. And we will also continue to play a leading role in the regulation environment for biofuels, where it's possible to create many
say 1.5 minutes and perhaps two. There's your flexibility and come back. So, Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The traditional job of the PI would be that of dealing with the problems set out in slide 14. That's the traditional job. We moved into an industrial policy. I was quite lukewarm, if not negative. There was a sort of lukewarmness within the country. And the notion, let's wait and see what happens. The concern was that we would have a publicly funded growth, not real growth. We are looking at now 172 billion, just summing up the figures here, with a possible 30,000 jobs created, with at a cost of 5.7 million per job, if those figures mean something. I'm trying to understand what is the cost and what type of transfer takes place from the aggregate of families to the aggregate of industry to make this industrial policy working. I asked the minister the last time, and he told me he will get back to us, so I hope this is the occasion, what is the cost of the preferential funding program? Because obviously that will increase the cost for each and every department to acquire those items which have been targeted for preferential funding. The second aspect is what is the overall cost of the industrial policy in terms of opportunity cost. This 171 billion, and that's just a figure, we know that it's much larger, if left within the aggregate of families, would be employed elsewhere. Is there any opportunity cost study? On the textile, we have the competitiveness upgrade. The only taste of competitiveness upgrade is export. We cannot import used clothing. We have increased enormously the cost of clothing, which we are all consuming. We are all cross-subsidizing this non-viable industry. We are now paying for the upgrading of their competitiveness. How much is it being exported? Is that tied to the fact that if they don't export, they need to pay back for the upgrade, or is it just a freebie from the consumer to an unviable industry?
The fact that when a
become massive that it affects the success of your own stimulation of particular sectors. So the question is, how do you get home affairs to do the right thing, and how do you get other relevant departments, and what stick do you have? I mean, I can see what the carrots are, but what is the compliance mechanism that allows ETI to pursue what is a very important set of projected goals? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to Mr. Zalt for his presentation. I must say I had a similar experience trying over the last couple of days to work through the documentation. It's incredibly difficult when comparing it to previous IPAC reports, progress reports, to get an assessment of what progress has been made from one report to the next. And I would strongly support the development of some kind of standard reporting format, which would allow us to compare directly one objective in year X compared with that same objective in the year before year X, and to assess the progress. My question, sir, is in the sections which the first few slides which you entitled your key achievements, as Dr. Janssen said, some of them are very impressive, and it's great to see the establishment of the 25 billion rand fund earmarked for the green economy. But again, there's scant detail as to the take up of these projects. For example, the one I'm most interested in is the 6.1 billion rand fund made available to support distressed companies during the global financial crisis. All well and good to have the fund and a laudable thing, but how are these advertised to industries, and what has been the take up of those by distressed companies? And the same applies to the other. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Sir Hill Lewis. Right. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I also have quite a few broad questions. Can you indicate how many applications for financing have been received in the last year, and how many has been approved? And more or less in which sectors that approvals took place. And do you also have an idea on how many jobs you have been able to create or to assist the creation of jobs over the last year? When it comes to the regulations on the new buildings, is there a consideration on the table to also regulate existing buildings or to create some sort of incentive to allow existing buildings to become greener? And my last question, talking about procurement, next wave, steady direction of IPAM, new wave of designations in the range of sectors. What sectors do you have in mind for this new designations? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Elvis. Right, Honourable Salah.
Thank you, NPG, for this progress report. We appreciate a lot that the sub-program that is going on in this area. But there are a number of areas I would like to just get clarity on. One is the issues relating to infrastructure. I think in other quarters you hear how much our infrastructure is old in a number of areas. For instance, electricity infrastructure, your rail infrastructure, transport infrastructure, not only rail but road as well, and a whole range of areas have got old infrastructure. This is a particular focus that the IPAC will look at creation of jobs through building of infrastructure and more. Well, I've just mentioned with respect to transport and electricity. And what is the protection of the money we put into the industry? The question of a fear that opportunity now to focus on this issue relating to greening. You have seen of that. Greening, there is a specific focus on ensuring that these new buildings are installed with solar heaters. We appreciate that. But I think we could go much further, because greening would not only be in respect of solar heaters. It would involve a whole lot of things, you know, like in the energy committee, they would talk about the energy efficiency and energy saving processes, fuel modification processes, you know, changing our fuel to create less emissions, the improvement in agricultural methods, low carbon coal use, you know, especially in the generation of low emissions generally in various other areas, in manufacturing, in mining, and so on. These areas, obviously, and these processes together and connected to create a green economy, a green environment. What amount of trade in terms of the EPUB do you think, or what amount of trade investment in terms of the EPUB do you think could be put in there?
Thank you very much, Honorable Salah. Honorable Kobasa.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I want to start off with slide 10, where you make note of the rising cost of energy, electricity in particular, and other things that cost. And I would like to understand whether the department is in any way attempting to deal with this challenge, because quite clearly, as the CTI goes on implementing EPUB 2 and re-industrializing, the cost of doing this gets affected by this kind of rise in energy, electricity, and other things that come. Is there anything that the TTI is doing in collaboration with EFCOM, for instance, to try and minimize this kind of challenge? Secondly, I'd like to understand whether in the course of implementing up to this point, are we seeing an emergence of new industries just in addition to protecting and consolidating existing ones? And that therefore leads me to the next question, which I think is the Honorable Albert also alluded to. If we could get a sense of the overall sense of the number of jobs that have been created so far, so that we are able to see whether we are moving forward in terms of not just only recovering the jobs that we lost during the recession, but also in terms of beginning to make a dent on unemployment.
very much, Honourable Kobasa. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, first of all, I'd like to welcome our new members or colleagues from the DA, Honourable James and Lewis, to the team of the Photography of Trading Industry. I think that we're going to have a long and fruitful discussion and help them charter the way forward for the manufacturing sector of the country. We welcome you in this committee. Comrade Chairperson, I think the first thing which I would like to ask, I really appreciate the situation whereby the issue of the green industry is receiving the attention it deserves. We can see that there's a possibility of real growth, in particular on the issue of manufacturing around that sector. But what is critical, what I want to know is that just like in the cell phone industry, most South Africans are using that gadget, but there's no South African company which is producing the cell phone, even in the IT equally so. What is the department doing to ensure that this green industry boom does not pass us by as South Africa or as a country? Number two, Chairperson, the issue of challenges and threats, which was raised on slide number 14, is the issue of the overvaluation of currency and volatility. Yes, I personally agree that when the currency is volatile, it's very difficult to plan the way forward. But let's look at the issue of the overvaluation thereof. When we look at our trade or our current balance, the reserve bank itself, you find that we're spending more money importing goods rather than exporting goods. Is it not an advantage that we have an overvalued currency in that situation? Because as we're speaking now, with all the infrastructure problems we're having, we tend to import more. And then if you look again on the on bullet number is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. On page 14, continued uncompetitive pricing of key intermediate goods. What you find again is that those goods, most of the goods which are made as input, are usually imported from the other countries. Will the issue of the overvaluation not cap that trend? That's the question I'd like to ask. And then on the other aspect is the issue of the steel price. We know that in the previous report of the IPEM, you find that the can of fruit, which is containing the fruit, it tends to be more expensive than the contents thereof. That's what we discovered. That's what we know together upon. So I'm wondering, why is the issue of the steel price not also put as a threat to the industrialization of the IPAM? Because I really appreciate the minister that he has designated and vegetables as part of the sector which must be supported. But the issue of the steel itself, the steel price, what effect is it going to have? Is it all right? Is there something which must be done around this? Comrade Chair, I'll just ask those three questions. I'll come back later.
Fine, thank you very much. Now we also have the Honourable Van der Merwe, I think.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think the presentation is to be welcomed, certainly, and I think one of the assets of this presentation is the narrow focus in many ways of the specific industries that have been targeted and the reporting on them. But at the same time, I have to say that also poses something of a challenge, because many of the colleagues here have talked about these things, and I think we need to get a broader picture also about, as my colleague Salau said, the infrastructure imperatives and so on. There hasn't been a lot said in the presentation about markets. Now, if we're going to be improving our manufacturing sector, we need to know where our markets are, and are they certain, and are they nearby, and how are we going to get the goods there. I think that in such a presentation, it would be good for us to get the linkages between the things that are being done on the ground and the things that are perhaps the responsibility of other departments or that are beyond the nitty-gritty of the narrow focus of what's happening in the area. You know, there's a global trend, I think, to the delivery of goods to places nearby. And so I wonder to what extent the geographic consideration of where these industries are placed is taken into consideration. For example, agro-processing. Are you processing for consumption in markets nearby, or are you processing agricultural products in ports or nearby ports that can be exported to a specific market? It would be interesting to know what the linkages are in all those areas. There is one thing that I'd also like to draw attention to, again on slide 14. It strikes me that half of the challenges and threats are issues that could be dealt with by government. They're not external threats and challenges. I mean, intergovernmental coordination, that is within the power of government to change. It shouldn't be a threat. I can understand that protracted recession abroad in the Eurozone and that, we can't help. But high cost and inefficiencies in the rails and ports and freight logistics, these are things that can be resolved. So my broad set of questions really resolves around what are the linkages with this IPAC with other government initiatives. Thanks.
Thank you very much, honourable members of the committee. That's our first bite at this. We also now give the department, Mr. Zolk, the opportunity to respond to that Bangkok question. I'm sure you know them. So over to yourself, Mr. Zolk.
Thank you, Chair. I think some of the questions, I think, require a little bit of kind of background and perspective. I think the first is that the Industrial Policy Action Plan itself is not a government, you know, it's not government directly or taking majority shareholding investing in economic activity. It's a set of actions aimed at incentivizing and facilitating private sector investment, largely in the manufacturing sector. We obviously do that through a range of instruments, including incentive instruments, which are run by our sister division, the enterprise organization, and reported on in the DTI annual report, as well as working together with the Industrial Development Corporation, which also has its own reporting structure, both through its annual reports and through economic development division. Now, I think that we can certainly try and work to consolidate, you know, provide a more consolidated picture by aggregating information predominantly from those two sources, because those really are our major source of information about the investment and jobs and so forth that we facilitate. We do report it, I think, at a fair level of detail in the annual report that we table with the committee. I think also just to clarify the reporting kind of structure that's in place is we put in place the Industrial Policy Action Plan at the beginning of a financial year, which has very, very detailed key action plans and milestones attached to that. And then within, I think we've been requested by the committee, within 6 months of the end of the financial year, we table the annual report and we report against those milestones. So there is a fairly well-established mechanism to report against what has been done within the Industrial Policy Action Plan, and obviously some of those key actions will happen within a particular year. Some of them might run over multiple years.
However, a very low proportion of that private credit extension goes into fixed investment in the economy, approximately 5%. So 95% of private credit extension, which has been growing rapidly, is going into household debt of some form or another. A lot of it is going into consumption through the extension of credit cards, store cards. A lot of it has gone into mortgages, and it remains an open question whether or not there's been a bubble in the property market. So part of what we've tried to understand in putting in place these mechanisms is why isn't more finance going into fixed investment and fixed investment, particularly in the manufacturing sector? A lot of one of the major reasons is that we have very short-term sources of finance in South Africa, and private banks are very reluctant to extend finance against short-term sources to long-term uses of finance. So, and the two predominant sources of finance are deposits, people placing deposits in banks, and also the increasing short-term and volatile capital inflows that we've seen in the economy. And this is why one of the reasons we think that there's been such a large increase in private credit extension, particularly to household consumption and to mortgages, because there's been a large increase in the availability of short-term sources of finance. But what we are concerned with as BPI is the availability of capital for longer-term investment. And by that we mean at least 5 years, if not 5 years, 10 years, even 10 year or longer. Because that's the kind of length of tenure that you require in order to make a manufacturing investment. And a lot of what we are working with IDC and through our own mechanisms, is to try and secure that longer term financing. So partly it's not necessarily a cost of capital issue, and we know that by and large IDC is run off a commercial balance sheet. So in order to do a cost, the opportunity cost analysis and cost per job analysis on IDC financing, it would be appropriate not to say take the 170 odd billion and divide that by the number of jobs. If you want to calculate the concessionality or public really have to take what is the difference in the commercial interest rate from a kind of concessional interest rate, and divide that into the number of jobs that are being generated, or the amount of investment that's being generated. So we believe that there's a significant opportunity cost in not securing finance and putting it into productive investment activities versus having the bulk of finance flowing into private credit extension, some of which the kind of viability of that is becoming increasingly questionable. And obviously, we can work on refining the methodology in terms of how we try and report and estimate what the true concessional element is for cost per job, but I think it needs to be placed in that context. I think there were two related questions on compliance mechanisms and intergovernmental coordination.
adopted a kind of user pay approach to the upgrade of finance, with very, very short time periods to increase those tariffs, increase the tariffs that users pay to the full levels of the cost of new investment. And that places a massive burden on the users of electricity, particularly in the manufacturing sector, who've got to absorb those kind of cost increases over a very short period of time. So those are, I think, much bigger questions within government, which require broader discussion and debate. And perhaps the only suggestion I have in that regard is that, you know, is that perhaps the committee can play a role in that respect in engaging in some of these broader issues and putting on the table the, you know, some of the cost to the economy of having such a rapid increase in electricity prices over such a short period of time. And I think there's probably a similar pattern and picture emerging in the way that we fund the rail infrastructure program. There's a question on the, I think specifically on the IEC distressed funding facility, how has that been dispersed, you know, how many companies have benefited, what have been the terms. I think that has been reported, I think, on a number of occasions, but we have to come back to the committee, you know, with the information from the IEC on progress to date, with how they have deployed that facility. However, I think it is important to note that there's no real concessionality in that facility that the IEC extends to distressed companies. What it's basically doing is it's pricing at commercial rates debts to companies that may be in distress where they couldn't raise that debt commercially because of the levels of risk. So what's happening is IEC is taking on a little bit more risk in that area to help companies get over a period where maybe they can't secure the working capital that they need, something of that nature. But there's very little concessionality in the pricing of that facility as we understand it. The question on which I think again relates to our incentive program, how many applications have been received for incentives, how many have been processed, approved, how much investment does that mean, how many jobs. I don't have those numbers in front of me. They are partially reported, certainly at in our annual report. But again, we can happily secure that information in the department and come back to the committee on those numbers. I think there were also a couple of questions on the stronger energy efficiency regulations for new buildings, and if I'm not mistaken, the key question was, well, what about existing buildings? That does pose a challenge for us because it's very difficult to go back retrospectively to households and say, look, we must take on some conventional steering, we put in a solar water heater. What we are doing together with the Economic Development Department is having a set of discussions with the insurance industry to try and secure an arrangement that when heaters break down, that instead of replacing them with conventional heaters, that they are replaced with solar water heaters. And again, in turn, obviously linked to solar water heaters that are assembled and have a significant level of local content in South Africa. I think there were certainly a broad set of questions around the infrastructure, the rollout of the infrastructure of our various infrastructure expenditure programs, and what are the economic opportunities, what are the job opportunities that issue of to what extent, you know, I think an analogy has been made between kind of social income grants that go to individuals who are, you know, in very dire situation, and some of the financing mechanisms that we're putting in place to help stimulate investment in the manufacturing sector. And we don't see this as a kind of reliance on grants or reliance on public funds issue, because we are trying to solve a fundamental market failure issue, which I tried to outline at the beginning, which is that the bulk of private credit extension is not going into fixed investment. It's going into various forms of consumption. And there's a whole range of market failures, the whole range of areas why private financial institutions are not extending that kind of finance. There was a question of what is DTI doing in relation to trying to help ameliorate or mitigate the cost of rising cost of electricity. There are a range of interventions that we're engaged with around industrial energy efficiency. For instance, there is a modest tax incentive that is in place that assists companies, particularly larger companies, to replace older energy inefficient equipment and put in place newer equipment. We're working to help facilitate access to that incentive. Part of it requires the ability to go out, capacity to go out and audit companies and say, you know, this is the level of energy you were using, and now that you put in this new equipment, this is how much you save. We also have an initiative called the National Cleaner Production Center, which goes out and does audits, energy audits, amongst companies and identifies areas where they can increase efficiency at the plant level. But what we also are seeking to do, particularly for small and medium-sized companies, whether we can't also find mechanisms, financial support mechanisms, to help them implement the findings of those audits and to replace kind of energy inefficient equipment where necessary. I think there were also questions about which I think again you know, we can try and back to the committee in writing in a bit more detail, perhaps making a distinction between what investment is domestic and what investment is foreign. Broadly speaking, much of the foreign investment has been in the auto sector by the automotive assembler. That's probably one area. Another is in the business process service sector. But we can try and come up back with a more disaggregated kind of set of figures to the committee. Then I think we fully take on board the comments of Honourable Khadebe, who makes precisely the point that we have made, that we don't want to be just that Africa in general and South Africa in particular have largely been the importers of and consumers of technology rather than being in part of the production value chain of technology. And really, I think that all the international economic evidence shows that it's the countries that are the producers of that play a role in the production chain that have grown and developed most rapidly. And we don't want to let, in particular, this green technology way, technological way, pass us by. We need to make sure that we embed ourselves as playing a fundamental role in the production of these technologies. On the question of, you know, isn't it a good thing to have cheaper imports and therefore isn't currency overvaluation positive rather than negative? At first kind of glance, yes, it will. Obviously, a higher value currency does make imports cheaper. But what part of our the what's lost to an economy when you import rather than produce is all the value added, all the linkages that arise from manufacturing something locally. So all the inputs, the local inputs that get drawn in, the value added addition that gets done, the kind of forward linkages, the services activities that get generated further downstream. And those far outweigh the kind of immediate cost of a product. And that's why currency overvaluation is a very, very profound problem for the manufacturing sector. On the question of the steel price, steel pricing and pricing of other intermediate inputs, this obviously remains a very difficult and problematic area. And I think part of it arises from the fact that that this is really what we're looking at and trying to influence private sector pricing activity in a context where they have very, very high levels of market dominance, because these are areas where they're natural monopolies. So they're large steel plants, a chemical plant, doesn't lend itself to small-scale production. They almost by definition have to be large-scale, so you end up with these natural monopolies. And the question then becomes, one approach is you'll just regulate the price, and that obviously has a whole lot of, would have a whole lot of implications, to start regulating private sector prices. So this is why this is why this is a long and kind of complex area we continue to engage with. I think that what we've done, so there are a number of things that we've done in this area. First of all is to make sure that there's no state kind of, the state doesn't add to the monopolistic prices by protecting the sector with tariffs, with import tariffs. So we've removed those in most of these sectors. We also, they are also under the intense scrutiny of the competition authorities wherever it appears on the prima facie that they might have engaged in anti-competitive behavior. But I think ultimately it is something that government is going to have to make a decision on this. How far do we go or don't we go in relation to regulatory measures? There's obviously a whole area of work around seeking to restore in relation to Kumba and Mittal the 21.4% that was intended to feed through to the downstream steel industry, but that is obviously again influenced by complex private legal processes and so forth that are underway. One area where we sought to address, at least to ameliorate the fuel issue in the designation, is we've said that very steel intensive products like power pylons, that we will almost deem steel to be local, even if it's imported, as long as the fabrication happens here. So that means that steel fabricators can go out and find the lowest possible steel price they can find, even if they have to import, so that we don't create a kind of monopoly effect inadvertently through these designations. So there's a whole range of issues, I think, and considerations that are coming up in relation to pricing matters of intermediate inputs. Then, Chair, I think there was a range of questions in relation to markets and which markets are we focusing on in relation to particular sectors. And I think in particular, should we be focusing on trading partners very close by, notably the rest of the continent, or work more further afield? I don't think there's a kind of easy or one-size-fits-all answer to our approach. A lot of it depends on the characteristics of the sector, what opportunities there might be, but I think that in a whole range of sectors,
are looking at net food importing countries, and we think that this might be a way of beginning to address some of the structural distortions in our trade with China, because China is a net food importing country, as are a number of Middle Eastern countries. But part of what we need to establish, and part of what we will support through this manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program, are market studies to identify more specifically what are the, you know, what precisely, how do we match what we produce and can export with what is being imported in some of these net importing countries. Thank you, Chair.
Members, we
are
taking questions from
my questions have not been answered.
I know, but what would be helpful if the Chair is allowed to conclude sentences that I know, and then you'll find your responses. Now, we have not concluded this, all right? There are also three questions which have not been answered. Not all of them. So, now I hope that addresses. I will just remind Mr. Zalk outside here just what he has thought to address, and he should start with that after. I hope everyone understands we have not concluded the long processes leading into this. We can see that. All right. So, I'd like to thank you at this moment. Obviously, I know you won't lose your job. And then also to take the opportunity of welcoming the Chairperson of Energy, you're very, very welcome. And that is, you know, really, very, very happy to see, especially on the conference here. Thank you very much, Honourable. Now, the other point is the minutes here. We hope that we'll be able to look at probably one set of minutes, because the one set does have a few errors in, and we don't want you cleaning up semantics and that kind of thing. We'd rather you cleaned up substantive issues on the matter. That those are the minutes of the 20th. They'll be at the next. The 25th are still here. So we also, now that we have got a full house, a warm welcome.
plant per province. I think that's how enthusiastic we were around those issues. So I think that it must be captured like that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. It's just unfortunate, I'm looking at members of the opposition parties on the committee, that Honourable Elvis was not here, so can't comment, and neither can the two DAs. But I'm sure you would have been alerted to any challenges by your colleagues. Is that correct? I must say, I looked at this myself. I was looking at 3.3 in particular because SEZ was, of course, the main issue of the day, etc. And I think it's a pity Honourable Ambrosini has just flown out. A critical moment as well, because he was there, and well, unfortunate, but I do recall us making a lot of points here, and I think that many of the points have been made. The point about the provinces is correct. In fact, he raised that himself, the Honourable Ambrosini, the importance of all the provinces having something there. The other thing was this point about the future of redundant industrial zones or business hubs established there. Now, we pull these things up, but yes, there was statements made about them. Of course, that wasn't maybe a general committee concern, but it was certainly a concern of a couple of members. What does one do about redundant zones, as was referred to by both the Honourable Salah and Honourable Ambrosini? So that, perhaps you'd like to comment if that is all that was captured in that regard. Honourable Salam, you also spoke to that. So we're looking at you. The other one here is this one about the capitalisation of the SEZ fund on page 2 and the granting of tax incentives for SEZ. And you know, while the issues emerge, they were also responded. Now, it's very difficult when we're not getting, you know, we just see issues emerge, especially in a discussion of that nature. And I think it is pertinent for us to have that handbag with us. Because to someone who's new here, yes, we needed you at this back time, Honourable Ambrosini. Exactly. Point I'm making. But the point is, you raised redundant SEZs or words to that effect, you know,
Welcome to 2012.
in other areas. I know probably during break, so yes. Highlight the areas that also want to bring. Let me just start with the census. I did a census with the chair. What I indicated is that the division of ETI that's responsible for the administration of the census is a different division of the type of organization. And that, I'm sure that information is readily available, and that obviously can't be ultimately cut by myself, so you have to get that right. So, and what we
very much, Chair. I had two questions coming under the heading of challenges and threats, and the one had to do with EFCOM, and the other one had to do with the point about the inefficiencies and high cost of rail and port freight and logistics. And it's to ask whether EFCOM is a self-interested industry, and it's crowded out alternative sources of energy, and the price increases we are looking at can be remedied, I believe, most significantly by introducing competition into that sector, both on the producer side and the distribution side. And so my question is whether there are plans to in fact do that. The same applies to rail and freight and port freight and logistics. It's pretty clear that when it comes to the provision of rail, that I can see how that is a state responsibility. But there's no reason whatsoever why you can't have competition when it comes to rolling stock. The same question applies there. Are there plans to introduce competitive dynamics into that part of the transportation system? And related to that is the fact that port clearance in South Africa, certainly in Durban, Cape Town is getting a bit better at it. But using e-government in the port of Singapore, it can take an hour to clear customs. And here it takes days to weeks. And so, again, a question about the compliance story. How do we get customs and home affairs, in fact, to improve their performance when it comes to questions of port clearance? Because that's an issue that affects investment and it's an issue that affects competition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Salt.
I have is that,
regarding energy, regarding rail, and all these issues which we identified as pertinent. I think the only ones we didn't invite directly then was finance regarding customs. Am I correct, Honourable Professor? You were those there. The Honourable Elvis, were you in that there? I think Honourable Elvis Seeley was. I'm sure in spirit anyway, yes. When you're physically present, of course. But I know that you contribute to that, what I mean, I recall the name. So there we are. A few of you missed out, and we identified this then as a critical issue. Now, I'm glad that the Chair of Energy, Honorable Di Palana, who was a member of the committee then, is with us here. His memory is very fresh about that. And I know he's been pursuing it with vigor. We may need, through the whip, to put this on our program and bring it back and see how we can work with the two other portfolio committees in this regard. Fine. Members, unless anyone else has any input around there as to how we use and can address this issue and really grapple with it. Honourable James, you posed the question. Any comments? Do you agree with that or what?
Yes, I do. In fact, that would be most welcome. Thank you.
Right. It wasn't really a debate. It was just that so that we can move into NIF. Right. Now, we go back to the department and ask you to give us the evolution. I don't think we'll use the Darwin here. But yes, the evolution of the opium, and we can have a little introduction again because our memories are not as good as yours.
Thank you. My name is Master Zakir Zimela. I'm the chief director for NIP. What talk about in the presentation, going forward and in support of the objectives of EPAP, how do we strengthen NIP implementation? And also to talk about how we, the previous presentation, we talk about designations, which is one of the instruments for leveraging public procurement. But how do we align and strengthen coordination between NIP and other instruments of leveraging public procurement, like designations, the CSP, which is the Committee Supply Development Program run by the Department of, or managed by the Department of Public Enterprise. But before we go into that, we thought it important to look at the how significant is the public expenditure, which from National Treasury estimates has grown from 4.6% of GDP to about 10% in 2009-2010. We think with the significant increase in ESCOM power build and also with Transnet in terms of locomotives and the port infrastructure, we think that has gone significantly from the levels that are shown here, although we don't have the exact numbers. And we also think that with TASA, the passenger rail agency of South Africa, going to go on a big spend in terms of rolling stock, that should further increase the amount of public spend. In terms of the import for the public spend, we think that our estimate is that at least 50% of the public spend has got there's an imported content which is above 10%.
$10 million US dollars. So it becomes important that we need to leverage use this government spend to promote the local industrial manufacturing. Let me tell you, if you look at back since Nipport was started in 1976, the obligations of 1996, the obligations have been in the region of about $16.5 billion US dollars. Of these obligations, 80% of the obligations have arisen from the strategic defense procurement package. And we estimate that there's been around 21,000 jobs that have either been created or retained, and export credits of about 11.5 billion and investment credits of 21.4 billion achieved. We did table a report towards the end of last year together with the DTI as part of the DTI annual report on all the projects. In terms of the leveraging of procurement spend, NIPAS was established in 1996, and since then there was a cabinet-approved competitiveness supply development program, which currently applies Transnet spend and is run by TPE. In terms of the CSDP, the state-owned enterprises need to develop supplier development plans, which aim to broaden the industrial manufacturing base of the country. Also, it supports the EPAP objectives. And recently, we've had the amendments to the triple PSA, which, as Nimrod talked about in the previous slide, it allows the Minister of Trade and Industry to designate certain sectors for public procurement. We estimate that of the, as mentioned previously, of the 900 billion state expenditure up to 2009, only 12% of that expenditure has been subject to NIP. This estimate we base it on the assumption or relative assumption that about 50% of the public spend has got some imported content, which is more than 10 million. The rest would be a spend in some infrastructure like roads and other expenditure would not have incurred any imported content. Since NIP has been a dominant policy tool for leveraging public procurement, then the majority of public expenditure has not been subject to any procurement level, which is before the designation, it was NIP and CSDP. So as I mentioned, the policy review then aims to strengthen the alignment of NIP with the other public procurement levers, which is CSDP, which is... CSDP and the designation. And also, the aim of... We currently finalizing a cabinet memo, other public procurement levels. We have presented the memo to the minister. We're in the process of presenting it to the cluster and then sending it to cabinet. We, in view of looking back reviewing what has happened over the past number of years, we're doing a project performance, or we'll be doing a project performance review of NIP during the next financial year. The policy review, the number of proposals as part of the policy review. But before I go into the proposals, we look at as part of the public procurement, also the designation of fleets, which would apply to the large procurement like I mentioned. Rolling stock, the electricity, a pylon by ESCOM, and other procurement that are repetitive. Then like the locomotives by Transnet, freight rail. So we'll designate those as fleets. And then we'll also have the designation as part of the triple PFA. That should be done by the Minister of Trade and Industry. Then also propose to split NIP into direct NIP and indirect NIP. Direct NIP will apply to those strategic procurements where we can effectively use NIP to support those sectors under that procurement, like aerospace, where we have actually used NIP to support local manufacturing of components for both the major aerospace manufacturer, which is Airbus and Boeing. We think we can continue to use this method of direct NIP, and also we can use in other strategic areas. Then there will be an indirect for all the other procurement, either not designated as fleet or not designated as part of the PFA or not part of the CSDP or not directly. Then the last thing, as I've mentioned, in terms of the policy review, we would like to strengthen the monitoring and evaluation of NIP, and also multipliers that are used we allocate the credit to have a methodology in terms of how we actually decide on the multipliers and have a second procedure to strengthen the allocation of multipliers. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Chair.
My question is, could you tell us who is defaulted to date on their offset commitments and at what magnitude? Keeping in mind that the expectation in 1999 was that these offsets would create 65,000 or so jobs and bring in 110 billion rand of investment that is set at 1999 price. Thank you.
Very much, Honourable James. Right, Honourable Melia.
Thank you, Jane. The presenter noted in his presentation that the strategic defence packages comprise of about 80% of the NIPs. And my colleague is absolutely correct. There was an expectation in 1999 that the NIPs and DIPs would produce the equivalent of 110 billion rand worth of investment and approximately 65,000 jobs. And it is my impression, Chair, that the NIPs, based on the evidence we have, are in fact a monstrous political fraud. And let me explain why. I refer to the department's report, which was submitted to this committee in September, the more detailed report to which the presenter referred. And I'd like to use an example to illustrate the problem. And I'd like to turn to page 7 of that report, where we deal with the German submarine consortium. The primary contractor in this contract was, of course, Ferrostar. Now, if you look at the report, the German submarine consortium had an obligation of 3 billion euros.
Just a minute, you're catching up on the hop. Because most of us don't have that report.
It was one table of your committee.
Chairing this committee. Not Mr. Knock. Now, I think, you know, I'm not just going to write off the question, but the issue is this. We do need to have prior notice so that members can have these documents in front of them. You put us in a very unfair advantage, including the chairperson. Disadvantage. You can see he's got me going all dyslexic here. All right. So what we will do is that you've had a minute or so, and then I interrupt. Please complete. I do not want a repetition of this. I hope that's clear.
Thank you, Chair. That is clear. I hadn't anticipated that the Department of Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee had, in fact, not read the document which was tabled in Parliament by the Department of Trade and Industry. I do apologize.
Just a minute before you carry on. Don't imply it hasn't been read. Would you like me to refer to documents page by page, which you may have read? Don't you dare.
I do apologize. Chair, I referred to the document where the German submarine consortium, Ferrostar, has an obligation in terms of the NIP program to invest approximately 3 billion euros. And in the document, we are told that that obligation has been met in full. So there's an expectation that the German submarine consortium has, in fact, invested 3 billion euros. Chair, that, it seems to me, is just simply not true. And let me tell you why. If we look at a document which is the result of an internal investigation into improper and questionable payments made by Ferrostar, I'd like to quote from that report, and I think that what the quote that I reveal, I think, would be quite shocking. The document reads as follows. Offset commitments were a particularly important part of the tenders for the submarine contract. In fact, official South African government documents show that the Ferrostar Consortium won the contract because of its superior offset offer.
only invested approximately 62 million euros and not the 3 billion euros that the DTI claims and that the public understands was invested. And if indeed that is true, has the department not misled Parliament, misled this committee, and misled the public of South Africa? And indeed, is this not a monstrous political fraud? Thank you.
You have 4 minutes or more. My own committee members of trade and industry get to. You have your second bite. Right. Honourable Elvin.
Thank you, Chair. My question is similar to the Honourable Mania's question, but it goes broader to all the obligations. I'm aware of companies who are doing work business for Telkom or have done Telkom that is trying to dodge their obligations, and they try to find any kind of manner not to invest. I even know some Canadian companies who suppose they are the people who want to save the world, but when it comes to South Africa, they don't want to spend any money here to create jobs. And what I want to know is, what systems do you have in place to police this and to make sure that nobody actually dodges their obligations when it comes to this? I find that many countries, and especially first world countries, have very clever lawyers, and they try to find all kinds of loopholes to not really invest in South Africa while expatriating our taxpayers' money when they do work for government. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Elvis. Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. What I'd like to ask here is a very simple question, Chair. With what, in which country is this NIP program benchmarked with? So that we can have comparison. And then number two, on the value of, I think part of this NIP is the issue of the technology transfer. How much below the technology transfer was given to South Africa in return for not only the strategic defense package, in all the other investments were done? And then number three, Chair, according to the page 16 slide, it says that the bullet number 1, 2, 3, 4, it says that there were 11.5 billion credit, export credit, and 21.4 billion US dollar investment credit. If you can average the dollar around 8 rand, it means that it translates to 343 billion rand worth of export credit and investment credit. Can they unpack in which sector those things affect the sector?
You
said
quite a page,
slide
16.
Yes.
Right, thank you, Honourable Kadebe. Honourable Amrutini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would like to yield my time to the Honourable Mania for follow-up questions and comments on the matter of extreme importance he has raised. Obviously, you did not hear me. Let me repeat. I would like to yield my time to the Honourable Mania for him to put additional questions or comments on the matter of national importance he has raised here.
Thank you for your hearing approach. However, as chairperson, I do the allocation and run the system. So do utilize your time for the IFP and yourself, Honourable Ambrosini, as an honourable member of Parliament.
Madam Chair, the healing time to a colleague, it's an established parliamentary practice, and I take exception to your not abiding by it. But I respect your ruling, even though I object to it. But I would like then have a clear explanation on one passage, about one passage of the Honourable Mania question, which he did not raise as a question amongst his final questions. which is the utilization of the multiplier to calculate the value of an offset. If indeed a multiplier was used in that manner, what are analytically the basis and the assumptions to determine that any type of investment that would multiply, what multiplier factor, and what are the international benchmarks used to determine that multiplier, and what type of public exposure and public disclosure there has been to the fact that the calculation of offsets was based on a multiplier.
Robustly and vigorously to get the information we require. Thank you. Mr. Zolk.
Perhaps I'll make a couple of points and then I'll also ask my colleagues to go into more of the detail. I think first of all we don't have the benefit of the report that was adopted, which I'm not going to quote it. However, I think we've explained a number of times how the how NIP works, how the system works, how the multipliers work, and certainly my understanding of the system is that companies, their obligations that are incurred as a proportion of imports in excess of $10 million, but those have to be discharged by introducing projects for which a set of multipliers is introduced, and that's undertaken. There's an internal process and committee and so forth that kind of adjudicates on the projects that are brought forward, decides yes, it goes ahead or no, it's not acceptable. And there, certainly the program itself set out in the rules and guidelines which are in the public domain, including some illustrations of how the multipliers work. But my understanding is that each project is considered on a case-by-case basis, and multipliers can vary from project to project depending on what what is put on the table in terms of the projects necessary to discharge the obligations. And further, I understand that the way that the team compiled the report, compiled the information from the program is based largely on audited information that is provided by the company, subject to an obligation on an annual basis. So that's broadly speaking how the system works and how the information is compiled. I think we certainly hear Chair your comments that when on the need to make a distinction between jobs created and jobs saved, and I think that's something we need to go back and make some refinements in the way that we report. I think that also, as we indicated in the presentation, what we intend to commence in the financial year is project by project assessment. So to go back project by project and say, okay, this is what you said you need to do, and this is the information you provide in order to say that and to make a project by project assessment of kind of on the ground project by project assessment of what was said and what was done and what the that correspond or does not correspond. So that's a very important work that we will be undertaking in the next financial year. Side by side with strengthening the program, because as the colleague has undertaken a policy review, and we have identified a number of periods. First of all, we need to be strengthened, and secondly, in the light of the introduction of other procurement mechanisms, that there needs to be alignment between the NIP and other procurement mechanisms. And one of the areas that we'll be looking at is the issue of multipliers, strengthening monitoring and evaluation of the program. And I think that probably one of the committees with the director to say, do some kind of international benchmark as well.
specific on the guidelines in DCI, in DCI website, where a table which shows how you can fulfill the obligation. And we included in all of those things, we've got multipliers for export, multipliers for investment. So an investment in an obligation of $3 million, for example, could be fulfilled by maybe an investment of $100,000. Or even without the investment, you've got what you call, you classify in terms of export promotion. You've got what you call export promotion, which is without investing anything, you can fulfill your obligation by supporting the promotion of South African value-added products. So when you talk about it in an obligation, whatever that value of the obligation is, we do not necessarily mean that companies need to invest that amount of money. That is similar in both the defense and the non-defense. Then in terms of the question around who's default on the cost, in terms of the FP, there is no company that is default. All companies have accumulated enough credit to offset. All of the five major companies have accumulated enough credit to offset the area they are obligation. On the non-defense side, there's one or two companies that don't have the means. Now, we wouldn't call that they defaulted because they're still negotiating with them. They've gone past the date on which they should have fulfilled the obligation, but they haven't met that. We are discussing with them in terms of rectifying and fulfilling the obligation. The question around some companies working for Telkom, I think we've always had companies not wanting to comply with the need of the issue. I think it's a strengthening of
difficult to actually push this because it is one of the I'm not sure. Actually cause that project to go
responding to some of them. But I can take a lot of time and close at one, which won't be very constructive to members, or we can complete our questioning and engagement. And then comes the end of the meeting and respond. All right? So I think I've tackled the ones of substance in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just a member of Parliament. I haven't read the intricacies of the calculation of offsets, but I got a general understanding. I did read the memorandum which went to Cabinet when the entire package was approved by Cabinet, and there was mention of multipliers. As a regular member of Parliament with two or three courses of economics, when somebody tells me multiplier, what comes to my mind is a factor of three. Three, push it to five, if you're really exact. The question is, without going into whether David is right or wrong, hypothetically, taking into account all the variables that have been given to us, the multiplier, the strictly intended, the credits, export credits, the indirect benefit of this and that and something else, can one conceivably have a multiplier of 48.3? Because the relationship between 3 billion and 62 million is 48.3. So Chris' question, irrespective, hypothetically, applying all your formula, matrix, other matrix, could you really have a multiplier of 48.3? Because if the answer is yes, hey, I never really passed, it never really crossed my mind that could be the case.
Let's compare with our own time. When that report comes to fruition, I'd like that comparison within the developing countries themselves, in particular, and then I'll appreciate that aspect. And then when coming to this issue of 343 billion, there's the investment credit and the export credit. Actually, when we take the procurement of defense strategic land, defense procurement packages, which was when was initiated, it was around 30 billion. So when you look at this credit, it goes to 343 billion, right? Which means that these guys will have met all their obligations to whatever. They will have the implication of that, of those values which are put there. Those guys will have met their obligations. Is it the situation as it is? And then the last question, that will be the new question, Chair. I'm not a conservative by nature. I don't like evolution. I prefer revolution. No, because if you go for an evolution, it takes many years. Yeah, it takes centuries to change a frog into a bear. Nah. It takes centuries. That's why I never believed in South Darwin. I rather believe in Deng Xiaoping and Hu Jintao. Said, just take government and private sector, put them in one room, hammer each other, and come to solution. And that's a revolutionary type, because a type of unemployment. So on this new type of program, Chair, what I want to ask, how many new plans or factories have been made in South Africa? The factories, not the productive side. Because without productive chain, we cannot fight unemployment. Thank you.
Yes, productive investment. Coming back now, we also had Honourable Harris and then yourself, Honourable.
Firstly, I apologize, I was late. Can I request? I need a bit more time. Can I request to go last? I'm trying to catch up.
We almost run out of time. You know how strict we are on the closing time.
Okay, I need a few more minutes while the next person
asks. Right, you've got then to have 1.5 minutes to do that, because that's all that the next speaker will be getting. Thank you.
Thank you. I meant that my question wasn't answered. We've established that the Ferrosol did not invest 3 billion euros, and we've established that that is because multipliers are used. My question to you and my question to Stan, well, if Ferrosol did not invest 3 billion rand, how much did they invest, and what was the multiplier? My claim is it was 62 million euros, and that there would be a multiplier of approximately 50. Is that true or is it not true? Because if it is true, I think it should be of huge concern to this committee. How is it that Ferrosol was let off the hook and only invested 2% of the total obligation? I think it's astounding. Chair, then can I just ask a second question? If we look at the document, one of Ferrosol's obligations for which it received credit was for an investment in the long walk to freedom. Now, I'm sure that members of this committee are surprised that a company like Ferrosol, which must be one of the most amoral companies in the world, is investing in a movie about one of the most moral men in the world. But what's surprising, Chair, is that I have a letter from the minister where he says that the total investment in this movie was 6 million euros. And if you look at the documents provided by DTI, they receive a credit for 300 million euros. Would the DTI please try to explain? Because again, that looks to me like a multiplier of 50. There is something, Chair, very, very wrong. And I stand by my statement, this are a monstrous political fraud.
I don't want to pass on that because I'll waste my time clearly with those who will not hear. But let me go to Honourable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. Firstly, I note yesterday rather unfairly the Business Day gave you a red light for failures in registering companies in the CIPC. I hope you don't get a similar blame for the failure of the Austin program. My question relates to investment, or the apparent investment
into the condom factory, Condomi. Chair, I have a document, which is a Ferrisdal document given to me, which says, and I quote, "The project invested in failed utterly, and the entire investment has to be written off." So my question to the DCI, therefore, is the amount that I have credited next to Condomi's name under the offset program is 501,000 euros. Is that number correct, and did the project fail completely?
Thank you very much, Honourable Harris. No, we don't want to... well, some of you could bring your calculators in the back. But let us proceed on this basis now. We're going to actually have Mr... Well, we know that's your favourite topic. Can you lower your voice? Now, Mr. Salk.
Thank you, Chair. I think the Chair, you've indicated that we should come back to the Commission with a written reply on kind of one pager on how the program works to address how the non-flows work. The benchmarking matter. In addition, Chair, I'd like to suggest that you also address the direct job in that just as a kind of rule of thumb, when we try and make some information that I have of, let me create one direct job, how many direct jobs you create, we take quite a conservative estimate of about 2 to 1. I think that we more uniform across say what would be the implications for the lip. There was a question on which companies have gone beyond their time frame and haven't completed and have not met the goal by the time frame that has been requested. I understand from my colleague that there are 3 companies. One is called Beretta, one is called 10X, and the third is called FTG. So those are companies where they have, not met the milestones, not disposed of the obligations by the milestones that it says that we're engaged in the same market. Rectification. I think, Chair, what we should probably do, I think, is in the absence of specific questions on project multipliers, I would suggest we add that to the written response, condoms, and so on. And I think also to add here that one of the things that we want to address in this project review is precisely, what is the situation with a particular project? If it received credit and it failed, why did it fail? Was it because of some kind of extraneous economic circumstances, or was it something to do with something that the Poppy Gores did not do? I think, Chair, the only in terms of time frame, the initial indication is that this will will only be in the later part of the 2012-13 financial year that I think we will start getting meaningful results out of what is obviously an extensive exercise of project kind of
We may need you here as we go through that report or written response, because this is a very important issue, the job creation issue, and knowing exactly how investment funds have been utilized in that regard. So I won't give a time, you know, you'll need to look at the program that we have, but it is a matter of urgency. But then simply to add that I'm a little concerned that, you know, we're still unable to get grips with the job issue in terms of actually knowing how many jobs have been created. I read this every time that ITEP2 has been presented, and I think it is a concern now of the committee. Right, let's just come back to one or two hands that I did.
In terms of compiling this brief report on the largely, I think, on kind of methodological issues, including methodological issues, but also the issues that you raise about jobs. I mean, that we can do fairly rapidly, and that won't take a lot of time. So, you know, in a matter of weeks, we can certainly come back on those issues, as well as, I think, on some of the questions that have been raised in relation to Ferrisol, which, I mean, we're in no way trying to avoid. We can go back to single figures and provide a detailed response to what has been asked.
Wow. Thank you. So, at least we get information then too. That's good time. Right. Now I did see some hands up before that. Now you had your hand up, didn't you, Honorable Gil Lewis?
I did that, thank you.
Yes, I think you were the first one up. And then we had Honorable Abrasini, Honorable Salah, Honorable Harris.
Thank you, Chair. Ma'am, it's a great pity that that Mr. Zal from the DTI doesn't have the figures with him today, considering the report was compiled only in September last year. It would have been nice to have an absolute definitive answer now on exactly how much Ferrisol has invested in the South African economy. But what is clear from the answers we have had is that it is a figure significantly less than the €3 billion reported in that document. Can we just have a verbal confirmation from Mr. Zalk that the multiplier figure is 50? Because that will allow us to look at the figures in that document and do something of a rudimentary calculation ourselves to get to the real numbers.
Thank you, Honorable Hill Lewis. Honorable Anthony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question has not been answered. My question has nothing to do with Ferrisol. Hypothetical. And my question was, put everything together, is it possible, conceivable to have a multiplier of 48.3? Yes, no. So at least we go on record. And that doesn't take a paper, doesn't check anything. One should know if this is the type of multipliers we are looking at, and perhaps we can have a frame of reference. That was my old question, which I really would like to have answered. See, no reason for it not to be answered. The follow-up question, Madam Chairman, I mean, we're looking at IPAP, we're looking at the DTI. If we get a condom factory to fail in a country where condoms are bought by government, by NGOs, distributed for free to everyone, there is unlimited demand, and the government supply and the government backed by government spending. I mean, this to me spells the peak of incompetence. So I would like to have an explanation of what type of oversight, what type of interaction, how is it possible that a condom factory fails, and how can we, against that type of failure, look at confidence in building up more important industry of the type that the colleague Radele was talking about before, the the cell phone industry, the different type of factories. I mean, it's shocking. So can one give an explanation? What went wrong there? Human failure, corruption, inefficiency. How is this possible?
Cannot expect to put people under pressure and force them to lie to us. Questions have been put before the department, and the department has said, we want to go look at our documents, compile an accurate report in writing and present it to you as a committee. And that's what I support. I don't believe that we must be here and say to the people, Samsung, say at least 48% out of Samsung, and suddenly take all that information to the media to go and put up press statements with vulgar words and painting the ANC
on a point by
the DA. We are not going to allow that kind of information. Not yet, and not today, and not now.
Now, I think that although that was not a question, it's a comment here, and I think that we're not allowing that. We've already made a position, you know, we've already taken a decision here, which underlines your point of getting a written report. We said that, but all we have said is that it is very important that that does not come as simply a written report. We want DTI in particular, the DPG, Mr. Zolt, and the Chief Director, Mr. Mary, to be here with us when that is here. And we're not waiting months for the first one. We're going to get it very soon. We just need to find the space. So I want to make that very clear to you. I don't think we need to go down that street again, because it is clear what is going to happen. And of course, there are some times I can see where parties are really very robust in their engagement and also like flying in reinforcement, which I suppose they are entitled to do. They're entitled to do as members of Parliament. You know, that is our fact. ANC could have done the same thing. You know, anyone can do that. Now, let's not go down that street and waste time and it's 1 o'clock.
Yeah, I don't wish to go down that street.
I didn't recognize your head. I'm not sure which committee you were in before that you spoke of when you like. Won't be in this committee. Not in this committee. Well, put it down now. We don't look at hands after one. No. No, we do not. Now, just let me get this right. After that, we have Honourable Harris.
Thank you, Chair. I hope I've spent long enough in the committee to not be regarded as a reinforcement just yet. Chair, I've got a question in two parts. The first is that the arms deal was sold to the South African public on the premise that it would create 65,000 jobs from the offset program. That's eventually the basis on which we made the procurement. Now, Chair, the slide on the board in front, on slide 16, says that since inception, 21,000 jobs have been in the entire NIPS program. And if we apply the same percentage, around 80% of the NIPS or the strategic defense package, you could imagine that it's around 16,000 jobs for the arms deal. Either way, whether it's 16 or 21, it falls way short of the original 65,000 promise. Is that the case? Have we really, DTI, fallen that short of the 65,000 target? then, Chair, this is not a traditional gotcha issue for the opposition. It's not, we're not simply trying to say the DTI has failed here. There is an upside. As I understand it, because the Joint Investigation Team report into the arms deal said that there were performance guarantees held in the form of bank guarantees, up to 10% of the contract price. This means there's a huge upside for the South African people. Because if these companies fail to fulfill their commitments, we could, according to what I read in the JIP report, impose those performance guarantees and take that money back. So my question, Chair, my second part of it is, are there still amounts remaining as bank guarantees we could claim back in response to the significant failure to create the 65,000 jobs promise?
That's the point, that question. It is really very valid, really. You know, we do need to look at that without doubt. And, we, you know, I'm looking at our time, and it's quite clear that is not, we're not completed in this area, and many of us have other engagements, not lunch. And so, you know, we also have to an eye on that as well. So I hope, Mr. Zolt, you're keeping a note of this, because, I mean, these points have been raised before. Right, let's just go to the Honourable Debbie, I think it was. Hang on. Okay. Well, you know, a very short indulgence, because we saw that we haven't finished the committee meeting, and this time is theoretically over, but we will allow you a minute, Honourable Mahia.
Chair, thank you. I just simply wanted to make the point that I'm astounded that the Department of Trade and Industry are as underprepared as they are. I find it completely unacceptable that they do not have this information at hand. And how is it that the Department can require a few weeks to calculate how many jobs were created by the National Industrial Participation Program and indeed the Strategic Defence Package. That information should be at their fingertips. This is not acceptable. I would also then, for the record, like to note that my three questions concerning Ferrosol and Long Walk to Freedom were not answered.
Yes, with respect to your Ferrosol question, I think we've already referred to that. It has to come back. With respect to the Long Walk to Freedom, apart from a few light comments on the matter, of course, that too is part of what we require back. It's just that time constraints do not allow us to just go on and on. That's all. So I hope that's taken in the manner in which I have stated it, and that clear understanding. Now, I want to make sure, though, that we did exhaust the hands that were up. There were some questions which are not fully responded to. That's another reality. And, you know, I think that we may need just a short admin engagement with yourself, Mr. Self, on the matter, so that we can just sort out where we are, and also the many people who can see that is your specific area of service to try and see how we can deal with this. And with the documents that have been referred to, I've asked the committee secretary to ensure that all members have copies of these documents so that we do know what is being referred to when we are in the committee itself, and don't like find ourselves as disadvantaged as we do today. All right. So I think I must make that quite clear there. But having said that, admin issues, we'll wait until after the meeting to pursue that. With respect to coming back to the meeting itself then, I put two there. You can see we did extend it to one. We did have certain closing remarks, and some of these closing remarks do include an announcement, which I do need perhaps to share with you so that members can consider being there. Honourable Ambrosini, I have closed
point of order, Madam Chairman. If I understand that the procedure you're wearing in now, you are allowing them not to answer even my hypothetical question, which calls for a yes or no answer, and I don't see why you would do so. All it needs to say is yes or no, and you are depriving this meeting of a piece of information which is relevant.
You are not in any form of being deprived. No, you are not. No. And don't include the nation along with yourself. What we are saying is simply that we have acknowledged. I can go on till 2 and 3, but I can't because we respect prior engagement. And no, Honourable Ambrose, that's not your normal behavior, I must say so, and recognize that. But what we are saying, do you think the committee is entirely happy? We would not be calling Mr. Zold here to set aside a time to continue this. Now, if you do not understand that basic communication, please see me afterwards and I'll explain it. Thank you. Now, get on with my announcement. There was an agricultural seminar to which we are invited, and I had a look at the date. Part of that date here, as you can see, is the 20th and 21st of February. Now, why do we go and bother to go to an agri seminar? I'm surprised you even say this. Because it directly involves the green industry, IPAC, job creation, everything IPAC too is about. Now, if you don't know that, then we have never further engaged. But it is the 20th and 21st. Now, the 21st is a Tuesday when we have a mandatory meeting. But the 20th is a Monday when many parties seem otherwise engaged, quite rightly. I just mentioned this, and it will be distributed to you. And then we'll see how many members are going on the Monday, and formally things, you know, we'll see what we can do about the accommodation and payments and pursue that. And then the other, so the 20th and 21st of February. Well, it's in the wine lands, as you can expect. And I believe those who went last time found it really, really, very, very not convenient.